I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. My guest today is Dr. Martha Hodes, author of the award-winning book, White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century South. This is part one of a two-part conversation on Like It Is.
Professor Hodes, I'd like for you to first tell us about your research and what places did it take you and who were some of the people you spoke with and how long did it take you to complete your book?
Okay, well, the book probably took me a total of about 10 years to write. I began the book as a dissertation at Princeton University, and then I worked on it to make the dissertation into a book. I conducted research at various archives throughout the South, and that included in the states of Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia, specific archives in those states, and then I used legal sources from all over the South, from the Deep South as well as the Upper South. And the experience of researching the book was very interesting. I was quite timid in archives in the South to let people know what I was studying. And so I would often arrive at archives and give a much more vague description of my project. For example, I might say race relations instead of sex between white women and black men. And what I found was that after several days, archivists began to know what I was working on, and really without fail, all archivists throughout the South, black archivists, white archivists, were extremely interested in the project and extremely helpful. I did have only one negative experience that I recount partly in the book, in which a white woman in Virginia, who was herself doing some research in the archives, she was doing some genealogical research, and she asked me what I was studying because I'd been there for a whole week and we'd been there together. And when I told her, the first thing she said was that I wouldn't find any information on relationships between white women and black men. And I politely told her that I had already found a great deal of information. And then she went on to admonish me, as she said, to make sure you say those white women are trash, which was interesting because it's partly, her words partly backed up one of the arguments I make in the book, which is that lower class white women, when they did enter into liaisons with black men, their lower class status made that transgression less dire to upper class white Southerners. And although I don't recount what I will now tell you in the book, the conversation from there really degenerated. From my responses, the woman realized that I began to understand her to be racist, and so she tried to make comments that would dissuade me from the fact that she was a racist, and she, as many racists will do, she kind of dug herself into a hole and said some very unpleasant things, and so it was all I could do just to remain polite to her and go back to my research. But let me reiterate, that really is the only such circumstance that I encountered, and just the last thing I'll say on this is one of the most interesting encounters I had was meeting an elderly white woman in the Virginia archives also, who was conducting some genealogical research for a family who wanted to know about their roots. And she had come across in the records that one of the white ancestors, a white woman, had had a child by the family's slave and had subsequently committed infanticide so that nobody would know she'd had a liaison with a slave. And what this woman did was she gave me the record. She said, here, you have a look at this. She said, I'm not putting it in the family genealogy because they wouldn't want to know, but I would like you to see it. It was really quite interesting. So overall, I had wonderfully positive experiences conducting my research in Southern Archives.
And my next question I'd like to ask you is, how do you respond or how have you responded to those who question the necessity to produce research on the topic illicit sex between white women and black men in the 19th century South? What would you say to those who may challenge the need to know this information at this time?
Well, one of the main points that I argue in the book is that Americans usually assume that white responses to sex between white women and black men have been unchanging and negative from the very beginning of colonial American history. The point of the book is to make very clear that these responses were not timeless. In other words, there was a historical trajectory, a historical development to these responses. And when I say these responses, I mean to the kind of lethal violence that ensued after the Civil War in the lynching of black men for the alleged rape or assault of white women. And so what I would say to that challenge is that it's extremely important for us to understand the history of that lethal white violence, and to understand that that kind of response, which is what I argue in the book, has not always been the case. And so what I found, and I must say I didn't expect to find this in my research. I expected to research a long history of lynching and white intolerance for sex between white women and black men. What I found instead was very interesting and very important. What I found was that under the institution of slavery, there was what I call a measure of white toleration for sex between white women and black men. And what's important about that is that it was the institution of slavery itself that prevented whites from committing the kind of lethal violence that came after slavery. And I would really like to emphasize that two very important people who made this argument before I wrote this book and who influenced me greatly, but whose words on this subject are often unknown, were Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells. And if I may, I'd like to just read you a sentence from each of their statements. In the 1890s, Frederick Douglass said the following. He said, "In the time of slavery, if a Negro was killed, the owner sustained a loss of property. Now he is not restrained by any fear of such loss." And in 1895, Ida B. Wells said the following. "The slave was rarely killed. He was too valuable. But emancipation came, and the vested interests of the white man in the Negro's body were lost." And so, again, my response is to understand the history of this particular category of illicit sex is extremely important in order to understand that it's not just natural or normal or something that would arise no matter what, but that it comes from particular historical circumstances.
I'm interested in knowing, were there legal sanctions on the books or against interracial sexual relationships between black and white women at the time during slavery?
Do you mean between white women and black men?
Yes.
Yes. There were laws on the books, but the laws were very non-uniform. In other words, for example, in the southern colonies, the laws that were written to discourage sex and marriage. In other words, there were consequences for doing so, but that wasn't the same as concluding that the marriage, a marriage between a white woman and a black man, was null and void. Now, in the antebellum South, that is in the South before the Civil War, there were laws, and some of these laws declared unions null and void. But those were laws about marriage. Laws about sex were much more tenuous. In other words, the prosecutions weren't always uniform. It wasn't always a crime that would land you in jail. It might be a matter of paying a fine. Or you might be prosecuted under the same law you would be prosecuted under if both of the parties were white. In other words, you would be prosecuted under an adultery law or a bastard law. And in fact, one of the things I found was that there were no specific laws against sex across the color line until during and after the Civil War, when the word miscegenation was invented. That word actually didn't exist in the colonial and antebellum South. It was coined in the 1864 presidential election when people who were against President Lincoln's reelection made the claim that he was running on the party of miscegenation, and they created that word from two Latin words, miscere and genus, meaning the mixing of race. So that was not in itself a category, a legal category in the colonial and antebellum South. Now, after the Civil War, the states began to renew laws against marriage, and many of these laws did claim those marriages null and void, and that is, of course, what happened in the famous Loving versus Virginia case in 1967, when finally all the laws against marriage across color lines were overturned by the United States Supreme Court. Richard and Mildred Loving had their marriage declared null and void, and they challenged that all the way up to the Supreme Court. So the laws have a very checkered history.
Now let's talk about in your book you talk about the marriage of Nell Butler, an Irish woman, and Negro Charles. I guess he didn't have a last name, or unless Charles was his line's name. They were married on the lower western shore of Maryland in 1681. What was the significance of their marriage from your perspective?
First, you are quite right that Charles did not have a last name, at least not in the records, and that was often the case for enslaved people. And Nell Butler did have a last name, as she was not technically a slave. Now, what happened in this marriage, which I discuss in the second chapter of my book, this marriage took place in 1681. Nell was a servant, and Charles was a slave on the same plantation in the household of a man named William Borman. They were married by a Catholic priest in a chapel, and white neighbors attended the wedding and talked about the wedding generations later. Now, the case entered the historical record because the descendants of Nell and Charles were all enslaved. Her children and grandchildren were enslaved, and they sued the courts in Maryland for their freedom on the grounds that they were descended from a free white woman. The significance of this case is tremendous. First, it points to the fact that in the colonial South, a white woman and a black man could be married, and that marriage could in some measure be sanctioned by their community. So although the marriage clearly provoked a certain kind of anxiety among the white neighbors, it did not threaten the foundations of slave society. And that was partly because in the colonial era, and this would change in the antebellum era, because servants and slaves were not actually that different in status. In other words, their statuses were quite similar in terms of subordination. The institution of racial slavery hadn't hardened the way it would in the beginning of the 19th century. Now, I should also say, and this is very important and significant, that according to the laws in Maryland in the late 1600s, a white woman who married an enslaved man, or a free white woman who married an enslaved man, was by law enslaved, as were all her children. That was the consequence of the marriage. And decades later, when the neighbors came in, the neighbors who were now very old, who had been at the wedding, came into the court to talk about whether Nell's descendants should be free, they remembered a scenario in which Lord Baltimore himself had gone to visit Nell Butler and said to her, "Why would you want to marry Charles when it will only make you a slave?" And she apparently retorted to him that she loved Charles and she wanted to marry him. So what that means is that white neighbors warned Nell that her status would be compromised, and yet she went ahead with the wedding in any case. What it also tells us, which is quite fascinating, is that a white person could be enslaved in colonial America. And I went to the Maryland State Archives, and I found the inventory for William Borman, who was the master of Nell and Charles. And there, listed in the inventory, is Nell Butler as a slave. So a person of non-African descent, in this case, was actually made into a slave. Now, in the 1760s, when her grandchildren sued for their freedom, they were eventually granted that freedom, because at that point, almost a century later, it was much harder for white Southerners to conceive of a white person as a slave. In other words, the institution of racial slavery had hardened and become much more fixed, and in that view, it was impossible for a white person or descendants of a free white woman to be a slave. And I'll just make a final point, which is that the law in the South was such that the status of the children came to follow the mother. That was not the case when Nell and Charles had their children, but by the end of the 17th century, that was the case. And that was a law that worked to the advantage of slave masters. More slaves could be created through the sexual exploitation of slave women if the children followed the status of the mother. In other words, if your mother was a slave, you were a slave. That knowledge of exploitation could be kept secret because with the children enslaved in the same household, nobody had to know who was the father of those children. And it also meant that the children could be raised by their mothers. For example, if their status had followed the father, there would be slave women whose children were free, and the white South wouldn't know what to do with those children. So there were very specific reasons why the status of a child followed the mother, and that changed after the marriage of Nell and Charles, when her children were enslaved. After that, after her marriage, it came so that the laws came to be written so that children would not be enslaved if they were the children of black men and white women.
Let me ask you a question. Are you on a portable phone?
No, I'm not.
You're not? Okay, I'm just hearing a little
I know,
static.
My phone can be staticky. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. I want to talk just briefly about the role of the slaveholder or the land owner. In such cases as a marriage or the liaison between black men and white women, at what point in these tight relationships would the slaveholder or landowner punish the man or woman involved in these relationships, and what would be some of the punishments? I know you just mentioned a few seconds ago about Lord Baltimore and his attempt to dissuade Nell Butler in her request to marry Negro Charles, but what was other reactions from landowners or slave owners, if you have that type of information to share?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because often the historical records are quite silent on what actions the man's master would take. What we do have information about, what does come to light in the evidence, is that the most disturbing factor in these liaisons was not the liaison itself, but was what would happen if children were produced from the liaison. The first thing is that any children produced from such liaisons were contradictory to what white Southerners would like to have seen in the system, the racial system that they had produced. In other words, the children, by the early 19th century, would be free because their mothers were free, and that was the law. And so what you had was children who were of partial African ancestry, yet also free, and white Southerners would have preferred all people of any African ancestry to be enslaved, and all white people, of course, to be free. And so these children messed up the system. They made it harder for everybody to tell who was what, who was slave, and who was free. Now, what I found, I have two different examples in the book. The first is an example of a case that begins as a rape case but ends up as a case of bastardy. And this is a case in which a servant woman becomes pregnant by a slave man, and she accuses him of rape. Well, what happens right away is that the slave is convicted, and he is put in jail. Then what happens, and this is very interesting, is that the townspeople and the people who are siding with the master realize that this white woman has told a lie, because she's given a certain date for when the rape occurred, and what they come to realize is that when she claimed rape, she was already several months pregnant, and she had been claiming rape in order to save herself from giving birth to a child out of wedlock by a black man. And so then what happens in the court testimony, and people gather petitions to pardon the slave, what happens in this testimony is that people come forward and begin to talk about how they knew all along that Polly Lane and Slave Jim, as he is called, he also doesn't have a last name, they knew all along that the two of them had been engaged in some sort of illicit liaison. People write petitions to the governor saying that they were walking through the woods one day and they saw Polly and Jim engaged in some sort of sexual encounter, and they walked on. And so what happens is it's not until the white woman becomes pregnant and makes an accusation of rape that people come forward to talk about this illicit liaison, which indicated to me that while this was going on and people knew about it, including the master of Jim, nobody took any action. And that's part of my argument, that this measure of toleration manifested itself in the form of indifference or inaction, which is very different from what would happen in the 1890s after the Civil War and Reconstruction in the era of lynching. Now, in another example I have, a white woman becomes pregnant, a white woman who's married becomes pregnant by a neighbor slave. And what happens here is quite fascinating. Again, it is clear from the records that all the white neighbors knew about the liaison, but nobody did anything about it until this woman had a child by the slave. Then what happens is her white husband files for divorce, and at that point, all the neighbors come forward and say, yes, we've known for a long time that this woman was having a liaison with a slave. And what's really fascinating, to answer your question more specifically, is that the man's master is very intent upon proving the guilt of the white woman and very intent upon excusing his own slave. And what's important here, and this relates to the quotations I gave you before from Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells, because black men were the property of white people, those white people were extremely interested economically in protecting that property, and specifically from protecting that property from violence or murder. And so part of my argument about white toleration is that black men's status as property permitted this kind of toleration, fostered this kind of toleration. In other words, slave masters didn't want to see their property destroyed. These were valuable men, sometimes worth thousands of dollars, and so it was in their interest not to punish the black men. Now, it is possible that the masters did inflict violence upon the black men in punishment, for example, whippings, and that those whippings never entered the historical record, and I do not discount that possibility. But it was interesting to me that none of those kinds of retributions ever entered the historical record. And again, I emphasize, it's not because white Southerners were sympathetic to their slave men at all. It was because they had an investment in these men as property. And once again, you can see this in the court cases. You can see there was actually a case in Arkansas in the 1850s where the jury was instructed that it was not worth the forfeit of a human life, in other words, the slave, in the case of a liaison with a white woman, because the white woman in this particular case had a bad reputation. She was considered trashy. She was considered low and mean and poor, and so the life of the slave was more important. There was also a case in Virginia where a slave was convicted of raping a white woman, and the master requested that the slave be pardoned, and he informed the governor that the man was, in his words, as he put it, he said, young and valuable. In other words, literally worth perhaps thousands of dollars.
I'm sorry. I didn't want to interrupt you.
No, so that is partly the stake of the masters in the black men as property.
So we've not yet discussed life for the black man after the Civil War, though we're getting to that. But at this particular point, if I ask the question, and I will, who was in more danger, the woman or the man, who would be in most danger at this particular point in time, period, in history?
That's a very interesting question, and I hesitate to say one more than the other. I can say, following from what I've just said, that, well, the woman would be in more danger because the man was protected by his status as property. And yet to say that a free person is in more danger than a person who's enslaved strikes me as rather absurd. In other words, what comes with the protection for the man is the status as slave property. So, in other words, what we have is the fact that before the Civil War, black men were rarely lynched or sentenced to death. But, of course, that didn't come to pass precisely because they were enslaved. In other words, the vicious and violent institution of slavery is what, quote-unquote, protected the men. Now, as for the white women, they suffered in many ways a much lesser form of danger. In other words, the white women in these liaisons often suffered ostracism, gossip. They were outcast from their society, which is not nearly equivalent to being the status of a slave. So although the white women were often the ones who were targeted, ridiculed, ostracized, they were also not subject at this point to any kind of sanctioned violence. I will say that it's not out of the question that the white patriarchs of the women's families, their fathers or their husbands if they were married, or their brothers, might not treat these women very violently, but that would probably only equal the condition of being enslaved. So that is, I think that's a hard question to say one or the other. I think just the condition of slavery itself makes it a much more dire situation for the men, even if their status in the community didn't change. According to these liaisons, their status was already so low compared to a free person.
You've mentioned previous poor white women. You've also we've been talking mostly about black men. The early sexual stereotypes about black men and poor white women during this period, what were some of them, if you can share some of those with us?
Yes, that's very important. Poor white women, and this is something that's often left out of the stereotypical images, often stereotypical images of white Southern women in a monolithic sense, is the idea of white female purity up on a pedestal, inviolable, and that this goes with part of this incorrect stereotypical view that white Southerners would never tolerate sex between white women and black men. The fact is, and this is something that runs through the whole 19th century, poor white women, the daughters, the wives, the sisters of non-slaveholding whites, often landless whites, were, and this is something that runs throughout history, were often considered to be inherently unvirtuous, inherently low, impure from the start. So that kind of stereotype followed these white women through to having liaisons with black men, although I have come across examples of elite white women who also engaged in sex with black men. Now, the stereotypes about black men and sexuality are complicated because, on the one hand, there is early evidence, in other words, going back to the colonial era, this idea that black men were more sexual than white men. At the same time, the institution of slavery also offered a different image of black men, and that's the image of Sambo, I guess, is what the stereotypical name would be. In other words, harmless, happy-go-lucky, not dangerous. And so those two images interplayed with each other, and of course they're quite contradictory. Now, what I did find, and this is quite fascinating and something I didn't expect I would come across in the records, in certain cases where white women and black men were found to be having a liaison, it was assumed or talked about that the white woman, if she was a poor white woman, had seduced the black man. And that's really quite different from what you will find in the later 19th century in the era of lynching, where no white woman, no matter what her economic status, was ever considered capable of consenting to sex with a black man. And so there's an example, for example, in the book, there's a case that takes place in Virginia where the enslaved man actually goes to his masters and says, "Your daughter will not leave me alone, and I can hardly stand it anymore." In other words, he doesn't want to have a liaison with her. There's another instance in the book where a black man actually recounts a story in which he makes the point that he was threatened by a white woman that if he didn't have sex with her, that she would then say that he had raped her. So in other words, there are real incidents of seduction of white women by black men, because after all, and this relates to the earlier question you asked me, after all, white women did have all the privileges of being white in a racist and racial slavery-based society, and so they did have power over black men. And then, of course, there are also the stereotypes of poor white women as extremely unvirtuous and low reputations that often were invoked to pardon black men who had been convicted. In other words, they were at first convicted of a crime of sex with white women, and then after the conviction, they were pardoned because the evidence introduced was that the white woman had such a bad reputation and was known to have sex outside of marriage or had given birth out of marriage, and so out of wedlock. And so that was invoked as a way to, again, to make the slave owners have the rights of the property in the men. In other words, by saying the white woman had a bad reputation, they could save their property from being destroyed, from murder, that is.
We will conclude our conversation next week on today's topic, White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century South. My guest was Dr. Martha Hodes, Professor of History at New York University. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.